United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Our minds draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-7105. Acti Sales Cabet, AF 21, November 2001, upheld. Spain, Inc. Ms. McCabe for the appellant, and Ms. Ryer for the appellee.
Ms. McCabe, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Monica McCabe, and I represent Ategel Scabet, AF 21, November 2001, which I will refer to as bestseller or appellant here.
I was hoping we wouldn't have to say that.
I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. A brief review of the facts will show why the district court's ruling was incorrect. Appellant is a Danish corporation and a manufacturer and distributor of jeans and other clothing worldwide. It has many, many customers, over thousands and thousands of customers worldwide, and thousands of Jack and Jones stores. It sells its clothing under the mark Jack and Jones. It's registered several different variations of the mark all over the world in 46 countries, and has sold millions and millions of articles of clothing under that mark. In mid-2003, it moved into Canada to start North American operations.
Let me ask you, as a practical matter, don't we have to decide whether or not you can raise new claims in the civil case that you filed?
Yes, Your Honor. We claim that the claims of bad faith and priority were already raised before the TTAB, and I have cites to the record if Your Honor would like those. But if the court considers them for some reason to be new claims, yes, we need to decide that, and I think the
well, you had this worldwide argument, but you didn't have that you were in the United States. Isn't that correct? You didn't raise that.
Well, before the TTAB, we raised the fact that we used the mark in the United States because by our advertising in Canada, it went across the border. We had internet domain names available in English, available to United States citizens. There was resales on eBay, and there are claims of that in the TTAB record. What happened was bestseller, an appellee, also the TTAB, applied the wrong standard before the TTAB. It should have been use in commerce, which means actual sales. Now, bestseller does not claim it had actual sales in the United States, but it claims it has use. It had advertising, it had promotional use of the mark bestseller in the United States, and under the case of Niagara, the Federal Circuit case, the correct standard is use, not use in commerce. And what the Federal Circuit said in that case is, even if the TTAB applies the wrong standard, even if the opposer, like bestseller here, uses a heightened standard of use, it's our duty to correct that mistake and apply the lesser standard of use, which we can show, Your Honor. And there's also reversible error in the district court because the judge would not allow us to admit further evidence of use in the United States, which was promotional and marketing materials of a bicycle race, several bicycle races where the name Jack and Jones was worn on clothing by the participants in the advertised bicycle race.
I know there's a district court case, one that I found, but is there more than one where a court has allowed new claims to be raised in the civil action?
Oh, yes. There are a number.
Any circuits?
In the Seventh Circuit, there are several. The CAE.
Is it more than dictum in those cases?
I don't believe so. There's spraying systems. There's also, I also believe that Gold Seal is not applicable here, which is the main case that the district court relied on here. Gold Seal relies on two patent cases, Luck v. Co. and Cherry Burrell. Those two cases are about patents, which talk about patent claims, not legal claims. When you file for a patent, you have to state the claims your invention is based on, and the scope of your invention is limited to those claims.
But the rationale is that Congress did not intend the federal district court to basically be an expert patent.
Exactly, Your Honor. And here, and in those cases, they weren't inter-party cases, Cherry Burrell and Luck v. Co. They were cases about the patentability of a particular invention, like a vacuum cleaner. Those cases were then bootstrapped into Gold Seal because they were out of the PTO. The court said, okay, we're going to apply the same rationale to legal claims about a trademark here in Gold Seal.
So are you relying on the plain text of the 1962 amendment then to say that the civil action is basically a de novo action where essentially you can start all over again?
Exactly, Your Honor.
And has any circuit gone that far?
Well, there's Hoover is a Supreme Court case in which there was a movement to get rid of the two means of appeal from a TTAB decision. You could either go to the district court or you could go right to the Federal Circuit or the Court of Claims back then. And the court refused in Hoover to abolish the two methods. They said Congress intended two methods of appeal from the TTAB decisions. One was to the district court where you get de novo review, and one was to the Federal Circuit where you have a closed administrative record. Bestseller chose to go to the district court precisely because it knew it had further evidence to submit. And in addition, what Hoover said was, this is what Congress intended, these two methods, and we're not going to abolish the two methods. And what happened here was Bestseller never got its day in court. It was dismissed on summary judgment before the TTAB. There was no testimony, no depositions. We never got to depose Bestseller's CEO to find out why, in fact, he chose an identical mark to Bestseller's. And when we asked for documents as to why they selected this particular mark as opposed to, let's just say, Jack and Jill, they claimed attorney-client privilege. Then we went to the district court and appealed, and we got dismissed on 12b-6, which also requires this court to use the de novo standard to look at that. So what happened is that Bestseller never got its day in court to prove its claims. It never got the opportunity to take discovery to prove bad faith and the other claims that were involved here.
Your bad faith claim, the district court looked at that, I guess, as misrepresentation. But it looks as if you actually had two claims.
Yes.
One that the application was void ab initio, and one that there was fraud on the patent office. Is that correct?
Yes. There's a federal claim under the Lanham Act, because under the Lanham Act, you can bring a claim for misrepresentation or bad faith, whatever you want to call it, in filing your application. And also, we brought a standard common law claim for misrepresentation. And it's the policy of Congress and the courts that bad faith, even if it wasn't raised below, can be raised at any time. Even after a mark has been canceled, an action can be brought to cancel it because of fraud in the application of to the trademark office.
But since it appears that the void ab initio claim is actually easier to do as a matter of just allegations, why do you need the fraud claim?
Well, Your Honor, we pled on alternative bases. I don't know that we actually need it, but I think we pled alternative bases so that the court and would understand that we had a misrepresentation claim, whichever way the court, you know, chose to review it. I think the decision below creates bad trademark policy. There are no cases on the issue of priority. There, between a 1B applicant, an intent-to-use applicant that's never used the mark anywhere in the world, or registered anywhere, versus a 44E applicant, which is Bestseller, where they rely on their foreign trademark registration from 1990. There are no cases directly on point, and therefore, I think this court needs to look at the outcome and the far-reaching effects the decision may have on other foreign applicants. 44E, if you look at the Senate reports and the legislative history, was passed to protect foreign registrants so that they can come into the United States with a mark they've used overseas and have it registered here simply without ever having to prove use of the mark or use in commerce of the mark. And what will happen if this case stands as it is, a preemptive filer can come in, take a mark that's been used around the world, but not necessarily in commerce in the United States, file for that mark, and block that foreign registrant from coming into the United States for years.
But, I mean, what about Section 7, which sets up the priorities and then has a couple of exceptions?
Yes, well, I think what Your Honor is getting at is this 44D.
I'm getting at how do we avoid the plain language of the statute?
I think by the statute actually tells how the mark becomes registered. And if you're a 1B applicant, you have several steps that you must complete before your mark is registered. You need to file an intent to use application, which is then examined. And then once it passed examination the first time, it must go through a second examination where they submit a statement of use and swear to use and provide specimens of use. And that's a second layer of examination, which Congress, and if you look at the legislative history again, intended to protect other possible filers for the mark from, of somebody trying to preclude others from using the mark in the United States.
You would need the registration if you were trying to enforce against somebody else, but does that really affect who gets priority in terms of filing?
Well, I think yes. Fame Jeans may have filed first, but they had no use, in the United States.
But my understanding is that the filing itself for intent to use application is considered a constructive use.
Yes, but it's contingent upon registration. Unless that mark registers, all the rights, constructive use, et cetera, don't happen unless there's actually registration. And what happened here is really the district court and the TTAB jumped the gun, because you're not even supposed to issue a final judgment until the mark actually registers, because they still have an inchoate right that needs to be perfected, if you will, by showing usage in the United States. Bestseller did not have that requirement. It just needed to merely take its 1990 registration in Denmark and show it to the Patent and Trademark Office, and its mark would have been registered but for the preemptive filing by...
But didn't you have to do that within 6 months?
Under 44D you do, and we don't claim under 44D.
Right.
We couldn't have... What I think Apelli tries to argue is that we should have filed way back in 1990 or 6 months after. We couldn't have. We wouldn't have had good faith intention to use the mark. We filed as soon as we had a good faith intention to use the mark. Now, if we had done it before that, we would be doing exactly the same thing that we're accusing Fame Jeans of, a filing before we really had a good faith intention to come into the United States. And because we contend that Fame had knowledge that we were coming into the United States, they zoomed to the Patent and Trademark Office first. And this, if you look at Shandong, Champagne, and some of the other cases we cite in our brief, as well as some of the legislative history, and the legislative history between an intent to use applications, the Senate reports, you see that that's not what Congress intended. Congress intended that there would not be a race to the PTO for filings. There had to be some equity involved. And there are cases where, even though there's a prior filer, the court overturns that because they're saying there's some equity involved in this situation. And I think this case is one of those cases where there's equities involved in the situation, and that we, at the very least, bestseller should have the opportunity to, under 1071B, to...
The equity principles also say you can't sit on your rights. And when did your... non-intent to use it in the U.S. back in 1990 turn into intent to use it, other than in response to Fame Jeans?
Somewhere in 2004 is when we intended to use the mark, truly intended to use the mark in the United States, and that's when we filed in December of 2004.
And is the support for that in your complaint? Because I'm trying to compare it to what First Niagara had, and it had the correspondence with customers, the spillover ads,
mm-hmm.
and so forth, and you've got, as I see, three allegations. I think the first one, paragraph 8, about your intent in Canada is probably a non-starter, but you've got in paragraph 14, access has to your brand has been available to U.S. customers through the foreign customers and stores as well as eBay.
Yes, in fact, customers go to Canada or Iceland to purchase the goods. That, you know, they're aware of the goods. The internet, you know, they couldn't buy over the internet, but they were the brand was advertised over the internet. And under Niagara, I think that's enough. Even national cable newspaper articles were enough for use in an opposition proceeding. It wouldn't be enough for a formal filing under, you know, use-based filing, but it's enough under an opposition like such that bestseller brought here.
All right,
that's the distinction that Niagara and National Cable make.
All right, that leads me to ask you, what is the status now? Because this was stayed during the district, the Patent and Trademark Office stayed during the district court, but as I understand it, you say that I can ask Best Jeans this, they filed their intent to use.
The mark has been stayed before the Patent and Trademark Office. The Fame Jeans. No, everything it registered and it was pulled back. It registered on December 25th, and based upon our representations that this court was still hearing the case, the Solicitor General pulled back the registration. So the mark is not registered. And everything is suspended until the outcome of this proceeding.
Fame Jeans has filed the intent to use.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
And what exactly? Because
do you mean the statement of use, Your Honor?
Or? I mean the statement. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
That was also pulled back,
okay.
So that everything is frozen in time as of the date we appealed to the district court, which should have been done prior, but was not.
Okay. And the other question I had. I got confused in the district court's order in its discussion of no standing because of the relief you sought. And I'm confused.
On the misrepresentation claim, Your Honor?
Right.
Yes.
And I'm confused because I can see if the judge thought that what you want is not only to cancel the registration or whatever, but to have the court order the Patent and Trademark Office to give you the registration.
Well, I think the court, all the court need do is just.
What do you want?
The court should allow our mark to proceed to registration. They don't have to actually say the mark needs to be registered. It still needs to go through the Patent and Trademark Office procedures, but allow it to register, allow us to put in any further filings that we might have to file so that we can obtain a registration.
It's wrong when it says in its footnote, plaintiff asks the court to direct the Patent and Trademark Office to deny defendant's still pending application and to grant its own.
To deny Fame Jeans' application, yes, because otherwise, if that application isn't removed, our mark can never move on to registration. I think it can direct them to move forward with the mark, you know, and take care of any administrative procedures that need to be done before the mark can register, because the court doesn't have a power to actually issue the registration physically.
That's what I'm asking, because it seems like he thinks in this footnote that you're asking for, in effect, a mandamus. That is,
that's not what we're asking for.
Don't grant theirs, grant theirs.
Right. That's not what we're asking for. We're asking for Fame Jeans' application to be denied and for our mark to then move forward in the process to registration, which should be done at the Patent and Trademark Office level and not at the district court level. I see my time is up. Is there?
All right, we'll give you a couple minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Byer?
Good morning, Your Honors. Robert Byer, representing Fame Jeans. In answer to Judge Henderson's last question, actually, on page 597 of the appendix, in paragraph 3 of Best Seller's claim for relief in the district court in its amended complaint, bestseller does ask that the court, the district court, direct the Commissioner of Trademarks to grant bestseller's application to register. The district court was correct in terms of its assessment of the relief sought in the complaint. Also, looking at the complaint, it is very telling. On page 591 of the appendix, paragraph 16 of the district court complaint, bestseller alleges that it was entitled to priority based on its numerous foreign registrations and longstanding use of the Jack and Jones mark in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. There was no allegation in the amended complaint that bestseller ever used this mark in the United States. Instead, we have to return to the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board record, where bestseller completely disclaimed any use in the United States. Page 53 of the appendix, in its response to the request for productions, opposer, meaning bestseller, has not yet used its Jack and Jones mark in the United States. That's why the Niagara case is completely inapplicable. We don't have a dispute here over what constitutes use. Bestseller contended that it never used this mark in any respect in the United States, never sold, never used. We have here a pure question of statutory construction based upon the plain meaning of the statute. Section 44 gives a six-month window to a foreign registrant in which that foreign registrant can achieve priority based upon its foreign registrations without showing a use in the United States. But that was not done here. And instead, what we have is an intent to use application filed within the plain allowance, plain language of the statute. And allows a party to file based upon an intent to use and gain priority. I should add here, in response to another question that Judge Henderson posed, with respect to the statement of use that was filed, that statement of use wasn't pulled back. Fame Jeans did file in December of 2007 a certificate that it's actually using this mark in the United States. And the goods listed were clothing, T-shirts, polo shirts, fleecewear, hooded pullover tops with pouch pockets in class 25. So there is an actual use by Fame Jeans in the United States, but the final registration has been postponed, has been pulled back pending the outcome of this decision. With respect to the requirement that issues be raised before the TTAB as a condition precedent to raising those in the district court, first of all, on the circuit level, there were two cases that were cited, both in the Seventh Circuit. We have the CAE case and the Spraying Systems case. The CAE case was an opinion by Judge Ripple, and in that opinion, and as Judge Rogers, I believe, noted, both of those opinions really contain statements in dicta, but those statements are not inconsistent with the principle that we have urged here. Judge Ripple's opinion in CAE makes two statements. First, Judge Ripple states in his opinion for the court that a party that chooses to go to the district court rather than to the federal circuit may request additional relief and may submit additional evidence. And then later on in the opinion, Judge Ripple uses a slightly different phrasing in CAE where he says that the party may raise additional claims. But in context, what that is referring to are the types of claims that would not be cognizable before the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board, but could be brought before a district court and should be brought in the same action, such as a claim for infringement, a claim to enjoin infringing use, a claim for breach of contract, the types of claims that we see that were before this court in the Sunmatch case. Precisely an example of types of additional claims that could be added to a complaint challenging a TTAB decision. The spray right, I'm sorry, the spraying systems decision, and also in the Seventh Circuit, Judge Kudahy's opinion, said that the pleadings may be enlarged. But again, Judge Kudahy is citing in support of that dictum statements from treatises that are the same statements that we cite in our brief to this court as establishing the proposition that you cannot raise additional legal arguments before the district court, legal issues that were not raised before the TTAB. And if one thinks about it, that would render review in the TTAB almost a nullity. It would have Congress creating an agency that would be completely superfluous because you could have a complete do-over in the district court. Now, what about this concept of de novo review? Bestseller has argued and concedes that review in this court is de novo, and we certainly concede that review in this court is de novo. But de novo review of legal issues in this court doesn't mean that this court can review issues that were not properly preserved in the district court. De novo review doesn't mean that you can have a complete do-over in the Court of Appeals, and the same thing is true with respect to de novo district court review of a decision of the TTAB. Yes, you can expand the factual record, but that doesn't give a party the right to raise issues that that party did not preserve in the TTAB. Here we have not only a question of a failure to preserve, we have express representations to the TTAB and in the district court complaint that are to the contrary of the assertions being raised on appeal by appellant. This case involves well-settled principles of appellate review, well-settled principles of administrative agency review in terms of how this situation is to be evaluated. Well, again, I think that the example of how that's applied is seen in this court's decision in Sunmatch, which involved, again, claims for breach of contract, claims for infringement, other claims that were related, but not a situation, and those were legal issues that are not cognizable before the TTAB. These are additional issues that are brought before a district court because that's where those issues should be adjudicated.
Is the common law misrepresentation claim cognizable before
that? No. There is no action for misrepresentation with respect to, there's an action for fraud on the PTO with respect to a completed registration. In that sense, Judge Lamberth was right. This is premature. This is still an inchoate registration, although entitled to priority by virtue of Section 7 of the statute. But with respect to misrepresentation, there's no showing of detrimental reliance, for example. There's no showing of plausibility. If we look at the Twombly standard,
But are you arguing that should be dismissed for reasons other than it wasn't brought before the board?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. Okay. So you concede that is at least an example along with the Sunmatch examples?
Yes, Your Honor. That is something because it doesn't go to the validity of the registration, doesn't go to the priority. What the TTAB has to decide is the right to register. And misrepresentation could be something different, although I would say that a party probably should bring that action before the board in the first instance, but it would have been premature in the case of an inchoate registration.
Well, how else would the opposition, if the opposition was based on the applicant's non-intent to use within 6 months. And if the ground for that was, as their ground is, that you were just applying to beat them, that you didn't intend to use it.
Well.
And therefore fraudulently applied.
Well, it's premature in the sense that you have to wait, and there's a sound reason for this if one thinks about it. The statute permits a registration, an intent to use registration. So you file an intent to use, and then you have a certain amount of time to file a certificate of use. The misrepresentation action, the action for fraud on the PTO, is premature until there is an actual certificate of use filed and the final registration issued. Otherwise, if you think about it, how do we determine, well, is there a bad faith use or bad faith intent? The proof is, well, do they file a certificate of actual use? Are they using it? Are they lying in the certificate of use? Of course, none of that is the case here. The only jumping of the gun that's occurred in this case is the filing of an action claiming misrepresentation with respect to an application for based on intent to use when the time to file the certificate of use has not expired, and the proof of the pudding again is that actually a certificate of use was filed. But
if that were true, how would you ever prove such a claim? In other words, if they're right and you have no bona fide intent to use and you never do it, you're saying there would never be evidence of that.
Well, if there's no certificate of use filed, then there is no registration to be issued, and the foreign applicant would have the right to proceed. They aren't held up forever, and they can use the mark in the United States without infringing in that instance.
That's not how I understand this to work, so maybe you can help me understand this. What I thought was happening here is when somebody says they challenge this on the basis that you don't have a bona fide intent to use, they have a prima facie case if they simply allege that and point out that you haven't shown any use. In other words, no documents to back that up.
Well,
that's all they have to do.
It becomes, you can look at that claim in a couple of different ways. First, that it's premature. Second, they didn't raise it before the TTAB when they could have, because that is dealing with the right to register, that there was no bona fide intent to use. But with respect to that, it defies reason as to why that should be cognizable when, if a party does file a certificate of use, then by definition, or a certificate of actual use, then how can you say they didn't have a bona fide intent not to use 6 months before?
I think we're talking about two different things here. My understanding is that the bona fide intent to use is an independent requirement.
It's a requirement with respect to filing the 1B application.
For intent to use. That's what 1B is, right?
Yes.
So an independent requirement of that is your intent to use. I don't understand why they can't challenge that. What's premature about that?
What's premature about it is they didn't raise it before the TTAB. The time limit for filing a certificate of actual use hadn't expired. And in the district court, the claim is completely implausible. That would be subject to the heightened pleading requirements of Section 9B, of Rule 9B of the Federal Rules.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. You keep going back to Twombly.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I think perhaps that's right if we're talking about misrepresentation or fraud. But why would that apply to the claim that the application was void ab initio?
Because from a district court standpoint, if you're talking about it based on a fraud on the PTO, there has to be an actual registration. Now, if you're talking about this as a basis for opposition to the intent to use before the TTAB,
that's all we have here.
That was never raised.
Okay.
The only thing raised before the TTAB in the opposition was that they use this mark in Europe and that they somehow should have priority based on use of a mark outside the United States. This issue was never raised.
So your argument is not that this challenge would be premature, but your position is they had to raise it before the TTAB, and they didn't.
That would be one of a number of alternatives. That would be the reason why this court would not have to go any further on that issue, which could be a nettlesome type of issue when one thinks about the fact that you have a 6-month time period to file a certificate of use. So what would be the purpose in allowing a challenge based on bad faith where the proof would be, well, do they actually do it? It's a type of issue that, how do you ever litigate that? But this court need not reach that because these are issues that have not been preserved. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Breyer? Mr. Breyer?
We're not done. We need to get to it. And that is there any authority in any circuit for sales through eBay to be enough for use in the U.S.?
Not that I've ever seen. The sales to eBay, or sales through eBay that are being alleged here are actually resales. These are not sales by the by bestseller. Bestseller is not selling its good on eBay. People who have purchased bestseller's goods are then elsewhere, are then, as I understand the contention, selling it. But I've never seen a claim where sales by somebody, I've never seen a circuit case. I think in theory, a foreign seller could sell goods in the United States on eBay, but that is not the allegation, as I understand it. We're talking about reselling.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McCammon, why don't you take 2 minutes?
I would just like to respond to a few of the comments by my adversary. First, there is cites in the record to our use of the mark, not use in interstate commerce again, but use, which is enough under Niagara and National Cable. On page 849, it says we own and operate a website that is available in English. On page 850, we talk about marketing materials that may have appeared in the U.S. from 1990 through 2004. Appellee also raises the issue in saying that the ads on the internet and other media in Canada do not count on page A103. So they recognize that we did raise the issue of use, not use in commerce. And again, it was bestseller's mistake, but again, under Niagara and National Cable, it's this court's duty to fix that mistake by all the parties and the TTAB and the district court. In addition, my adversary cited to the amended complaint, and if you look at A589, we again allege websites being available in English since 1997 to American citizens, the fact that U.S. customers can buy items overseas and on resales through eBay. And we also allege in the amended complaint that we have new evidence of use in the United States that we should be permitted to bring forth before the court. The reference to the statement of use, I believe, Your Honor, is completely outside the record. There's nothing in the record before this court that talks about the statement of use, which was filed with the TTAB after these proceedings had begun. So I don't think the court can rely on any of those issues because they're not before the court. I want to take the court back to material supply v. Sunmatch, which my adversary also mentioned. There's an important fact that I think the district court overlooked here. Because the TTAB granted summary judgment, we were entitled to complete de novo review. We're entitled to do it all over again. Usually it's a hybrid standard. If they had given us a trial before the TTAB, then it would have been a hybrid standard, de novo as to law, and something else with respect to the facts, deference to the facts. But a finding of no issue of material fact is no finding of fact at all, and therefore, under spraying systems and material supply, as well as the other cases we cite in our briefs, that on page, specifically page 11 of our main brief, that means that we were entitled to a do-over. And if you read the cases carefully, even the cases cited by the district court, they say that when you have a summary judgment below, the standard of looking at the evidence and admitting claims is different than if we had had a full-blown trial below. And that's why Gold Seal, the main case that the district court replied on, does not apply here. There was no full record developed before the TTAB, and we had no chance here to expand, my adversary talks about expanding the factual record. We never had a chance to expand the factual record, either before the TTAB or before the district court. We couldn't put in our new evidence, which we allege go to the issue of priority, which was brought before the TTAB. I see my time is up.
Thank you,
Your Honors.